The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the final stream for tonight. We are starting an hour late. I do apologize to everyone for that, especially to the guest. But the previous stream went on much longer than I was expecting. That's something to do with the two-hour gap between each stream. Sometimes that works well, sometimes it doesn't. It overruns. But generally, 2 hours is a good gap. So my guest is George Bagby. George, welcome to Millennial. This is your debut on Millennial, so thank you for agreeing to appear.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Would you like to briefly introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes. I call myself George Bagby. I am an American history teacher. I've taught American history for 10 years in private high schools. I'm from Louisiana, as my followers note. I love my native state. It's a weird and special place. I'm particularly interested in American regions, in particular my native South. And in my career, I've taken special care to note the differences between groups of Americans. And that those are regional differences. They're political, cultural, immigrant group differences, and also the well-known racial tensions in American history. All of those things have been part of the way that I've traditionally taught history. And when I was canceled about this time last year and lost my job, suddenly these things were put under scrutiny. And I came to find that it was only a special group of people that was really willing to talk openly about these things without dissimulation or terror, right? about these matters. We all know what it means to be terrorized by these questions in the Western world today. Questions of identity and questions of history. Right? Who do we relate to in our history? What stories do we adopt about ourselves? What things do we have loyalty to? What groups do we have loyalty to, and why? And of course, the vast majority of those loyalties are organic loyalties. They're just loyalties that we're born with, right? And my contention always is there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong about having native loyalties to your ancestors, to people groups, to places, to belief systems. Those are just how people come naturally. This is part of the fabric of human life and existence.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a strange person who doesn't have a natural loyalty with their people, their group, their culture, and their area, the place where they grew up. How can these things not be meaningful? It really surprises me and kind of disgusts me, actually, when, you know, I won't name names, but certain content creators that I used to spar with who would sing the praises of being detached from these things. That seems very unnatural to me and not good, not a good idea.
Yeah, it certainly isn't a good idea. Those that throw their own people under the bus, it's like throwing their own parents away or dismissing the value of their own family, their own mother and father. That's patricidal. You know, that is a particularly evil sentiment, particularly evil energy. It's malignant and it's self-destructive of its own nature because we are literally built out of our ancestors. They gave us our bodies. That's why we respect our mothers over all other women in the world. That's why we respect our fathers, and we're meant to respect them over all other men in the world. It's a natural, organic tie and loyalty. And when people are set in a particular place for really any period of time, it doesn't even have to be very long, they start developing an affection for a place as well. They develop ties to a place. That in my region of the country, that was always related to things like graveyards. A traditional American greeting that you'll hear from, I suppose, most Americans is, "What do you do?" And when an American asks you about yourself, it's a particular sort of greeting, like, "Where do you work? What's your job?" In the South, the traditional greeting was, "Where do you bury? Where are your people?" Right. And those questions correspond. It's like, where do your people come from? What bit of land do you have ties to? And that shows an older character about the South, a rooted nature of my particular region that I've always been fond of.
That's quite dark. Where do you bury? That's rather yes. Macabre.
Yeah, I suppose it is. It can be morbid from some perspective, but I've always enjoyed it. I've always made graveyards, cemeteries, a particular place of interest. I've always stopped at them. I recently had the opportunity to drive in Mississippi. I traveled in the countryside in Mississippi and explored a couple of small towns, and I have people that are buried out there. An old cemetery that I'd visited once before, it's way out in the middle of nowhere. It's not on its way anywhere. It's in a very remote corner. And I just happened to be in that area. So I went back and I saw where my relations were buried, and toured the cemetery, read the names on the tombstones, you know, said some of the names aloud. And there's something so antique about that. We know that the ancients used to talk about the two kinds of death, the time when you physically die, and then the time when the last person dies who remembers your name. Right. When your memory truly ends.
Yes.
Yeah. And in the South, we've had an affection and an energy put into the remembrance of things past.
That is interesting. I wonder, first of all, the word graveyard, I didn't realize that was actually used in America. But because that's what we say in Britain. Cemetery is not a very common word in Britain. But graveyard...
Really?
Yeah, but then as I say this, I remember that Stephen King had a book called Graveyard Shift. So I guess it must be a recognized word over there. One thing that comes to mind, nowadays, perhaps within America as well, but also outside America, it's popular to criticize America, to attack it as a fake country, an artificial country, a Disney empire sort of thing, and also beholden to other interests. I think it's important to, and shallow, you know, hollow, this kind of thing, supermarkets, shopping malls. I think something that's often forgotten is that America used to be a very different country. And the states, each state used to be very distinctive in a way that I don't know if they are. I don't think they are as distinctive now as they were 100 years ago. And it was also a more rooted culture than it is today. I mean, the consumer society of America today is not the way America always was.
That's correct.
Yeah. Would you like to take that and see where
absolutely.
You go?
I share your sentiments on this, that it's very lamentable that the American states have lost a lot of their uniqueness and they blur into each other. But you'll find when you encounter Americans, you encounter Americans that will refer to themselves as American and will not distinguish between regions of the country or the differences between their state and another state. And then you will meet other Americans who will tell you what state they're from, and they believe that it matters. It is still very much that way with a Texan, for instance. Texas, they have a wonderful reputation for that, and they model that for the rest of us. It is that way for Louisiana still. And that's one of the things that I particularly love about my home. Louisiana is a place that still has a very distinctive way of cooking that's very different from the rest of the country. We're rather famous for it. We attract a lot of tourists based on our cooking. And that's something that's still a lived tradition here. People still know how to make gumbo and red beans and rice, and they eat it all the time. And then we sell very high-priced versions of a very simple food to the tourists who arrive, right? But we still have a special sort of music that we're famous for here. We have many musical traditions here that are very famous. Jazz, probably being the most important, was born in the city of New Orleans and then spread around the world.
Yes.
But these are things that we enjoy. These are parts of our lives here still. And when you come to Louisiana, you'll hear people playing music with instruments. You'll hear them singing. And you'll hear them just playing instruments in their yards and such, or beside an apartment building in the city. And it's a really unusual experience because you don't necessarily run into that in other places. And it's a special kind of music that you hear. So it's still part of our lived experience here, and that's one of the ways that makes it special. But you were quite right that these things have deteriorated as the country was knit together by highways and commercialized. We're all eating the same hamburgers and fries now. We're all shopping at Walmart now. And we increasingly have this debased consumerist culture, which is a facsimile of the real thing. I like to tell my guests, because since I lost my teaching position, I've been driving Uber in New Orleans full time. And I like to point out to my guests where they can find real diners in New Orleans. And I tell them, this is what the chain diner wants to be. You know, this is like the platonic form of what the chain diner
right.
Yeah. You actually get the real thing here. And that's a big draw. So much of our cities now are fake facsimiles of what inspired them originally. But you can still find the regions of America. They are still there. And I'm always fighting against the alienation of that, of the blurring of distinctions in regions. We must push back against that alienation that makes our whole world this homogenous, undistinguished mass, the global American empire, as some call it, the gay. We have to push back against it. And one of the ways we do that is we emphasize those regional districts by loving them, by living them. You can't just hate the big box store. You can't just hate the mass produced Happy Meal or something. You need to get into the kitchen and cook what your people traditionally eat. Learn these recipes and such. It's not enough to hate the canned music you hear over the radio and emphasize of how this doesn't correspond to actual life or your values or whatever it might be. Go and sing something. Learn songs. Learn to play something. Participate. It's by participating that we push back against the alienation of modern West, the decadent West.
Yes. One other aspect of the distinctiveness that I think is was really taken away during the course of the 20th century was that was linguistic differences, where a town would be German. It seems incredible now to think that it was ever like this. But I believe that around America, you would have a town where everyone basically spoke German, and another town where everyone spoke Dutch and French and so on. It seems incredible now. I believe this is the truth. Do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, there were regional languages in America. We had a huge German-speaking population right up to World War I. And it was part of the crazy backlash against all German things that came with the declaration of war against Germany to join you, our British brethren, in fighting the Deutsch in World War I. We came over to fight the Kaiser, and meanwhile, we canceled everything German at home. So the teaching of German was banned all across America. German language newspapers, which were really big deals in many American cities, German language newspapers in places like St. Louis and Cincinnati, these big cities in the Midwest, places like Wisconsin, there were German speaking towns in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, still a lot of German people up there, ethnically German. But with World War I, they were strongly encouraged to change their names to something that sounded more American. You know, the Schmidts became Smiths, right? The Johanns became John. They changed their names, and the teaching of German was extinguished in the American schools. For a time, the playing of German music was banned. It was really extraordinary. It was like an ethnic cleansing movement against German things that swept America. And that it shows you something about the nature of Americans, that we get swept up into hysterias based on foreign policy things from time to time. you can kind of see Americans going both ways right now, which is a very unusual event.
The
passions are riled right now, both in favor of Israel and also in favor of Palestine. That was not the case at all with Ukraine.
Yeah, or Iran, or the Gulf War.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So this is a very unusual event in my view. This doesn't happen very often at all, and I think it has to do with the breakdowns of official narratives and maybe the lack of credibility of our authorities that broadcast these narratives. But that's an aside. But yes, we've had a lot of regional languages and cultures in the course of our history. Very famously, down here in Louisiana, we still have a measure of spoken French. That's especially the case in the very low parishes. Here in Louisiana, we're the only state that has parishes instead of counties. Right. Every other American state follows your British model of referring to counties as a local unit of government. But here in Louisiana, we follow the French Empire's name of these units, and we call them parishes. It was a church government sort of model, not the English model, of course. But we still have a measure of spoken French down here, which is a very special thing that we now treasure.
Yeah, well, I would like to ask you, I don't know if this is the area that you wanted to focus on, but I would like to ask, how did this end? Like this distinctiveness? Obviously, you've talked about First World War, but it seems to me, and please tell me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that the Second World War was even more effective in melding the United States together into a much more homogenous entity. And really creating the America that we have known all our lives, where it's the hegemon, and then latterly, you've got the 50s with technology, the atomic age, NASA, the nuclear threat, the UFOs, B movies, science fiction, And then in the 60s, the moon landing and the hippies and Woodstock. And then,
well, then we had a huge
consumerism is what I'm getting at there. So, yeah, you take it away.
Of course. We had this major boost after World War I and again after World War II, where the industrial base of Europe had been destroyed. The Europeans, you had all destroyed your industrial cities, and the working age male population of Europe was decimated by war. And so American businesses had an incredible opportunity, a once in a century opportunity. They got it twice over. They got it both with World War I and again with World War II to market their wares in Europe. And of course, you know the story of the Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
And we came in with a new element of foreign policy, a new tool to use in our foreign policy, the foreign aid package, which we now see as a major influence in world affairs. The war in Ukraine would not be continuing now if it were not for massive injections of money from the United States government. The war in Gaza would not be going on now if it were not for massive injections of American money into that conflict. And this changes the way that things are done all around the world. But that was invented with the Marshall Plan. And it created these huge opportunities for American corporations in Europe. And this was a means to export all sorts of American ideas as well. And I have a great deal of sympathy for my European friends who identify this as a tremendous enemy of the things that they most value about their homes. And I regret that it has done so much to deracinate Europeans and turn Europeans against themselves. I'm reminded, though, of a quote from a favorite author of mine, from Richard M. Weaver, who was a Southern writer and essayist. He posed the question, has America corrupted Europe or has Europe corrupted America? He said, there is no answer to this question, for each in its own way has yielded to the same impulse. And he mentions how Europe had abandoned its old loyalty to its own forms and embraced various modern ideologies that are self-destructive. Marxism and the Frankfurt School came out of Europe, after all, just as an example. But that's not to minimize the damaging influence of the American government in European affairs. That's certainly been the case. You asked, how did America change? How did these ideas that are now so current around the Western world, how did they get exported by the American authorities? And the answer is partly how Americans changed their view of themselves during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, and then later on during the civil rights era in the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson was president. And the American project, as preached at that time, was that we were going to be a post-historical people. This was a particular idea of liberalism, that all people could be governed by the same laws. All people could exist under the same administration of rules and regulations. This was inherent in ideas about global government. You found both of these things in miniature with the League of Nations, Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations right after World War I, and the United Nations, which was the official name of the Allied powers in World War II. Both of them were pushing popular ideas among the American and British elites who backed them up and provided most of the brain power for those institutions, that all people in the world could be considered without reference to their places in the world without references to their histories, to their ethnic heritage, to their religious groups. The idea was a liberal progressive idea that none of those things really mattered anymore. And that was not the norm in America. I would say it was something foisted on the American people even after World War II. That was not how the typical American saw himself. Americans still imagined that their religious beliefs mattered tremendously, that determined how they saw the world. They imagined that their place in geographically, that determined how they saw the world. They believed that in spite of those differences, they could be united politically, but they saw the union of their interests under the Constitution, under a federal government here in the United States, not under a world authority. And this is one of the reasons why Congress resolutely refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles and to join Wilson's League of Nations. Even though it was the idea of President Woodrow Wilson, the American Congress refused to turn over sovereign authority to that unit. That now wasn't the case with the United Nations, where the United States was a founding member. But we see here it was the compelling, progressive, leftist ideas of various American administrations that made these institutions and started spreading these ideas very influentially in the Western world. I am antagonistic to this post-historical view of human beings. That is not how people live. That is not how people are motivated. People are motivated by loyalty to the dead. People are loyal or motivated by a loyalty to God. People are motivated by a loyalty to a place. To get rid of all those things and say, oh, well, we can all unite for the sake of common prosperity or something like that, or in the name of human rights or something, to do away with all human distinctions is something that has never happened in history before. We can name any number of motivations that could spur a man on to sacrifice himself and die. But I think that we'll see very few people in the end sign up to die for something so abstract and unrealized and also so ill-defined as human rights. Say.
This has been the whole problem about the wokeifying of the American army over the last 20 years, that in the end, people don't, they talk, it's like loyalty to LGBT is, a mile wide and an inch deep. No one will actually fight and die for that.
We see some of this working out in modern America now. We see the exclusion of many servicemen based on their refusal to take the certain experimental medical procedure a year or two ago. And now we see a broad unwillingness of young Americans to sign up to serve in the military. And this is blown up into a serious crisis, especially as the U.S. government maneuvers itself into various conflicts. They just don't have the soldiers to support these ventures anymore. And they seem less likely to get them in the future. And we see the chickens coming home to roost here. People are willing to fight and die and sacrifice for something that's close at hand, for something that they know, for something that they love. They are increasingly unwilling to sacrifice for abstract goods that are difficult to explain, however laudable we could possibly define them to be. That's not my point. I'm just saying that human beings are less likely to die for abstract things. They're much more likely to die for home and for the altar. they're willing to die for the memory of things that they love, for places that they regard, for people that they love. Those are things that motivate people. But to tell them to die for abstractions, in our day, they grow increasingly abstract and impossible, and that just doesn't work.
Yeah, I agree. One other thing about post-World War II, when America expanded and exporting things to Europe, and also expanding its influence around the world, that's obviously one part of the story. But then that's the empire. That then has an effect internally on the country. You know, there's the empire, and then there's the country of the United States. And what would you say was the effect of the long-term effect of World War II on America itself as a country?
Well, it put us into a new foreign policy role that we have inherited, much to our detriment these days. Americans have been telling themselves a story that they are the leaders of the free world, that they are the leaders of the good guys, in effect, and that they have some responsibility to exert their influence and military power at any point in the world, at any moment it might be necessary. So if there is a tsunami in Indonesia, Americans automatically think, I think this is the way that most of my countrymen understand things. They imagine that the U.S. military ought to be there, that the U.S. military ought to be helping. If there is a controversy, a flare-up, one country goes to war with another, the United States government feels a responsibility to take sides. And as much as I would like to say that is the action of unaccountable elites in the Pentagon or the State Department, I think that most Americans expect their country to take sides. And it's not the way I want it to be, for certain. That's just the way that Americans have grown to think of themselves and to think of their country, to think of what their government is for. They've come to think of their government as having responsibility for the whole world.
Yeah, the moral policeman.
Yes. And there is a tradition of that. We can see that in a number of presidents in the 20th century. So I'm not denying that this is an American tradition, but I am saying that this is new, relatively. I mean, my country is not nearly so old as yours, but this is a story that Americans have told themselves in the course of their history. And that's something that I've been insistent on with my students. The rise of the actual American Empire in 1898, when the United States went to war with the Spanish Empire, and we grabbed several of their colonies. And we didn't restyle ourselves as an empire. We didn't formalize it. But the people that were in charge of conquering the Philippines and Puerto Rico, administrating Cuba and various countries in Latin America that we started taking over at that point, the Marines would go and land and in places like Honduras and Haiti and start administrating the governments there by force, collecting the taxes, making sure the American banks were paid for their investments there, various things like that. Helping the banana growers take over in Guatemala and commandeer the government for their own purposes, things like that. The American military, the American government was complicit in those things. But the people that were designing those things, they called it an imperial project. And that was back before Westerners thought that imperialism was always an evil thing. That was back when, you know, the British were doing it. Obviously, the Germans were doing it. Americans could do it better. All right, so we got in that game for a while, and we never stopped. We just changed the way that we titled it, and now we do it all over the world. And this is part of the reason why the United States government is so deadly earnest about their influence in Ukraine and why they are unwilling to give up that place of influence and control, even when it looks like most military age men in Ukraine will be sent into bloody trenches on the front to die.
Yes.
The Ukrainian government's conscripting women now.
Yeah. And the elderly. Various things like the average age of this platoon is 45 and stuff like that.
It seems ghastly. It is so evil.
Yeah.
It is so evil what is going on there. And the people in Washington, D.C. are egging it on. They want to see this happen. And part of that is because they will lose tremendous amount of clout if it doesn't continue to happen, and if the resistance folds and Ukraine surrenders or something. I have no idea what is likely to happen, but it doesn't seem like the government of Ukraine can continue to do this. But the only reason that they found themselves in this situation is because the Western governments, your Boris Johnson over there and the demented criminals that run my regime, interfered in this and made sure that this would happen.
Yes, it's been manufactured. I completely agree. They made it happen. And I'm not entirely clear on the reasons why. But I think it has to, it's probably to do with the Israel lobby, but I'm not exactly sure.
I know that no one can get to the bottom of what the president and his son were really up to in Ukraine before all of this violence broke out.
Oh yeah.
But we know that they had an awful lot of financial interests wrapped up there. For what purpose, I have no idea. But they are personally invested. And who knows what all that is about. I don't pretend to understand it.
No, especially since Joe Biden, the president, does seem to be pretty senile. I mean, I can't imagine him cooking up a criminal plot on his own at this stage. Maybe 10 years ago, he was more with it. I don't know. As for his son, it's just astounding that with what we know about his son, with the various photos that have been posted all over the internet, even videos of him cavorting with prostitutes and whatever, it's just staggering that the son of the president is doing that kind of thing, and it hasn't rebounded on the president at all. I mean, and I know conservatives, right-wingers are famous for saying, imagine if it was the other way around, and but really, and the thing is, I think this in itself has degraded America, because everyone knows it, even liberals, even Democrats know at some level, some maybe subconscious level, they know that they are supporting a massive corrupt lie. And I suspect that that does play on them to some extent. I'm not saying that that will make it all fall apart. I'm just saying I suspect that's part of the reason for the lack of energy that you're seeing just now with the presidential stuff that's coming up. There just doesn't seem to be the left. The Democrats seem to have run out of, they don't have the energy that they had 4 years ago. And I suspect that part of that is, as I say, that they at some level know how dreadfully corrupt the Biden presidency and family are. And it disgusts them.
Both the left and the right, the establishment, left and right here in America, are out of ideas. They are really at the end of the rope. All they can think to do to preserve their own station in the system is to shore up their own power and to make sure that the system continues to operate more or less normally. And this is why people from the outside of the mainstream that have suggested major changes, people as various as Bernie Sanders and Robert Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump, are all rising stars. People are very interested in at least what they are willing to say about major changes in the American system. But I think that it's quite clear that things cannot continue to go on as they've gone on. The American empire has no place left to expand. Its influence is contracting. The United States government got pushed out of Afghanistan. This is still an incredible shock. I don't think that most Americans have paid attention to it or have thought about it since it has happened.
Perhaps
the fact that
Ukraine just took over from it. I don't know.
Yeah, the end game in Ukraine and the current drama in Israel and Palestine, all of these things have much to do with the continued operation of U.S. foreign policy as normal. And I don't see any of these things working out to the advantage of the world controllers over in the State Department in Washington, D.C. They are all likely to be highly disappointed with what goes on. They're going to lose clout. They're going to lose influence. They've already sunk costs all over the place and have nothing to show for it. If you think of the trillions of dollars spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, that's an example. So all that to say, a very roundabout way of saying Americans since World War II have been told by all of their leadership in a coordinated way, they are the masters of the world. The American way of life is the way everyone ought to live. We need to export our ideas. We need to, just like we need to export the things we make. Why people all around the world should be watching American movies and learning how to talk like we do. And we've been also neglecting our own domestic well-being. We've been neglecting the well-being of regular American people for a long time. Our real wages have stagnated for decades. Our yes. quality of life is dropping.
Yes, this is a thing that's not often commented on, but it's quite amazing when you realize this, that America, in the 90s and 2000s, it always looked so rich. Everything seemed gleaming. I remember watching Home Alone and then Home Alone 2 and he's in New York. And, America just seemed great. But the truth is that since, what was it, 1974 or 75, since then the wages have been going down relative to the cost of living.
Indeed. Yes. Not only is our standard of living going down and the value, the purchasing power of our regular wages or average wages is dropping, but our life expectancy is also dropping. Our healthcare is infamously the most expensive in the world. I understand that your national health service over in the United Kingdom is a difficult political problem. You can't get service when you need it and such. Well,
that really here I simply where you are in the country. It's actually a complicated thing.
Sure.
Yeah, the NHS is bad. And if you're in a big city, for example, yeah, it's going to be bad. But yeah. So I don't mean to take you out.
Well, here I've heard horror stories about American medical problems. My whole adult life, I had a roommate once upon a time who fainted. We don't know why. He never found out why. Maybe he skipped a meal. I know for a fact he was not a good eater. He really needed a woman in his life to make sure that he ate something that would keep him on his feet. But he collapsed in public, and a good Samaritan picked him up and took him to the hospital. And he woke up at some point while they were doing tests on him. And then he owed the hospital $20,000, and he was a college student. He was working a fast food job. He made enough to pay rent and go to school, and he had modest means. He had nothing to fall back on, and he had to pay it all, and he had to drop out of school. He paid on that for years, just to get it behind him.
That is astonishing.
So, yeah, you can get medical care here still, but no one can afford it. I certainly can't afford it. I've known
several Americans, you know, upper middle class, who didn't have health insurance because it was so expensive.
I don't have health insurance. I haven't had health insurance my whole adult life. Yeah, health insurance is for wealthy people.
Yeah.
Doctors are for wealthy people, so far as I'm concerned.
That is terrible. That's no way. I mean, we talk about the West and life in the West, and that surely is no way for people in the West to be living. That's kind of right.
I know it's utterly unsustainable, and I can't do a thing about it. As a private school teacher, my school had enough employees that they had to, by law, offer us a healthcare program. But we had to pay into it. In order to get basic coverage for myself and my family, and this would include a high deductible. So I think the deductible was something like $5,000. After the doctors have racked up $5,000 treating you, then the health insurance kicks in and starts paying for it. So it already had a really substantial deductible. I don't have $5,000 just sitting around for an expense like that. So if I had to have a hospital visit or even a regular doctor's visit, say I developed strep throat or something, it's, you know, a doctor's visit that might cost $500, say, for the visit and the prescription to treat the infection. I had to pay for all that out of pocket, even though I was insured, right? The high deductible terrible. Plan.
And $500 for a doctor's appointment. I mean, that's criminal.
Yeah. So what we end up doing is we get on welfare. That's our alternative. We get on public assistance like we are impoverished people.
Yeah.
Even though we're ostensibly middle class.
Yeah. There's a joke in London. The property prices in London are so high. There's a joke that if you live in London, you're either very rich or you're on welfare because no one else can afford it.
Indeed. Yes. I can see that. Well, I'd have to turn down that high deductible healthcare insurance because it would have absorbed most of my monthly paycheck to pay for that. It would have been higher than my mortgage and all my utilities and everything I spent on groceries every month.
That's insane.
And like 75-80%.
The free market is supposed to solve these problems. It really does rubbish a lot of libertarian arguments, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how it's supposed to work. I know it didn't work for me. But going back to an old point, maybe to move on our conversation, when I lost my position as a teacher, I've been teaching American history for 10 years. I'd been making curriculum for my students. I would edit primary sources for my students. So I had a reader full of firsthand accounts from American history, Lincoln's speeches, excerpts from Federalist Papers, all sorts of things. And I would have discussion questions after every one of them. And we would find ourselves talking about the conflicts of groups in America, because that's part of the story of America, conflicts between a great many groups. Originally, it was different groups of British settlers in the original 13 states. The very famous conflict between the New England Puritans and the Virginia and Carolina Cavaliers. They took different sides in the English Civil War. The Puritans were very enthusiastic supporters of Cromwell. The Cavaliers down in Virginia were open supporters of King Charles. They called the Puritan renegades patricides and regicides. And condemned them. They offered to make Virginia the new home for Charles II, for his exile. Of course, he turned them down. He knew that France was a far superior option, and I certainly would have gone to France if I had been him. But I still love the thought of Virginia as the new royalist kingdom of the Stuarts. But this is a conflict that continues on in American history, and then later on, there are many other groups that come into play and that end up taking sides. So I've always been very interested in the conflict of these groups, but one thing was always a stable, understood norm, especially before the American Civil War. Even for a long time afterwards, though by the time you get up to the 1960s or so, it becomes very unpopular, politically incorrect to say that British Americans founded the United States. British Americans gave us most of our place names. British Americans gave us the institutions of our government. If we look at the composition of the Philadelphia Convention that writes the United States Constitution, if we look at the background of the authors of the Federalist Papers, and for that matter, the Anti-Federalist Papers, the people who oppose the Constitution, they are overwhelmingly English-American. And this is a very important part of our heritage. Now, there's a great Hungarian-American historian. His name is John Lukács, a great Catholic writer. He taught in Pennsylvania for most of his career. Lukács says in one of his American history books, the most important event in the history of modern America is when the British Americans, or just generally the white American contributions, were no longer normative in the American story. And the ideological notion of Americanism, that anybody can be an American, that it's something you believe, civic nationalism, if you will, that became the norm, that became the establishment narrative of American history. And that certainly follows after this World War II regime that I described, the establishment of the United Nations, this idea that the American way of life should be the normative way of life for everyone in the world, that our ideas should be made normative everywhere, the global American empire stance. That is certainly the establishment story of what American identity is now. And it's unsustainable. It will not last. It cannot survive a serious encounter with real limits. It cannot survive encounters with history. And that's one of the reasons why the conflict in Ukraine stands out to me as such a significant contest. I remember at the very beginning, the president of Russia made a number of speeches. He frequently has very interesting things to say. And he said something about history has not concluded. Human beings still have things to fight over. There are things that still inspire the nations of the world to fight. And he was obviously countering the Western narrative, the dominant Western narrative that's so current in your country and mine, that we should have an order originally established in the United Nations that's going to prevent all of those old loyalties of land, of religion, of ethnicity from creating wars in the future. The president of Russia said, no, that's actually not the case. People will still fight for these things. And he seems obviously right, no matter what we might think of that. It's certainly very, very disturbing to us. But he's right. History hasn't stopped. Francis Fukuyama was wrong. The fall of the Soviet Union did not mean the triumph of Western liberal ideas in the whole world and the end of fights about the good life. What kind of life do people want in various countries, various ethnic groups around the world? We still differ on these things, and these things are still something people will fight for. And that doesn't mean that we're all going to die in a global conflagration, but it means that history hasn't ended, and the American idea, the global American empire, is not totally triumphant without any challengers. That is not how it ended. It continues, and these contests continue. The global American empire will not survive these challenges. And yeah, Americans need it. We need a different way of thinking about ourselves. We need a sustainable, wholesome way of thinking about ourselves. The imperial ideas have made us hate ourselves. It is preventing us from having a future. And we have to have a different way of understanding ourselves. We have to have a different way of thinking about our past so that we will not hate ourselves. We need a wholesome narrative.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, I think it seemed like a wholesome narrative for quite a while. I think it's something that Americans were able to derive confidence from until quite recently. I'm not sure. I'm not an American, so I can only speculate on these things.
I wonder when that turned around. I know we had an awful lot of soul searching after the war in Vietnam. And you may remember a line from that period of time. It was a leftist criticism, but it held true. Some critic, I don't even remember who spawned it. He was poking fun at American policy in Vietnam, saying, "Oh, inside every Vietnamese is an American trying to get out. And so we need to go there to liberate them, to help them become Americans in some sense." And of course, it was just a lampoon of American policy. The policymakers themselves didn't speak of it that way. But that was a moment of soul searching. The foreign policy wonks referred to that period as the Vietnam syndrome. They said that Americans were hesitant to get involved in the affairs of other countries. And the planners at the Pentagon prioritized it as something that needed to be overcome quickly so we could resume, you know, projecting our influence, foreign policy aid or military intervention all around the world. And they could get on with their great imperial globalist project. But that can't continue. We simply can't continue to pay for it. If nothing else, we can't afford all of these commitments. And someday it's going to come down to, will we pay the old age pensions in America, or will we continue the military garrisons in hundreds of countries around the world? And
do you think it's sustainable? I don't think it can go on much longer. It just doesn't feel like that. It's not going to be 20 or 30 years from now. And maybe it will be, but it already feels now like these are the last sort of 5-10 years of it.
It does feel like it's far past its prime. It feels so tired. Americans are tired. And they're tired because they're beating their head against a wall. They're throwing billions of dollars around the world, billions of dollars they don't have. And for what good? What has it done? It's just more dead Ukrainians. It's more dead Palestinians. It's not doing good. It's not doing something that we want to see. And it ought to stop. It ought to stop. And we ought to turn our eyes back to our own home.
I certainly agree. And I do think that that would be better for Americans. And I think it would be better for the world. But again, it's easy to say that. There is the fact that with America no longer as world policeman, other powers would take up that mantle.
Yes.
And who knows what that would be like?
Well, I think in the short run, it means a major decline in global trade. just because the American Navy wouldn't be able to maintain those trade routes. That's one of the things that the U.S. Navy is doing. It's one of the things the British Navy used to do, is to make sure that those trade routes were safe. Your Lloyd's of London insuring it all to great profit. yes. Was Lloyd's of London, was it originally in London? Why do I think it might have been Scottish? Isn't Scotland famous for shipping insurance as well?
I don't know, actually. I know that the Scots did well in banking. I know that that's true. They were known for prudence. And there are several famous Scottish banks, but I don't know about Lloyd's.
Here in America, when we think of the Scots, we think of fighters. We think of Davy Crockett. We think of Andrew Jackson. We think of them screaming and going and fighting the Indians and the Mexicans and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I've just looked it up. Lloyd started in Birmingham, England. So no, it wasn't Scottish.
Okay.
And it was Quakers.
Oh, my. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Usury for the Quakers. Okay.
It's surprising. Well, I mean, this has been a fascinating stream. I've largely let you talk and take it where you've gone. I think this has been very interesting. Are there any other aspects of this that you'd like to talk about before we finish?
Yes, I think we've got to have a healthy understanding of American groups and the conflicts they find themselves in. And this was where I finally had a falling out with my employers. I was sat down and given a statement they wanted me to sign, saying that race did not exist. That in particular, race did not exist. And the argument that my employers were making, this was a Christian institution, and they said that good Christians cannot believe that this is an element in human life. And I thought that it was an interesting statement of an old American orthodoxy. And you can find this based in the phrase in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And this is John Locke's liberalism, if you will. And there is an awful lot built into our American system based on some of these notions. But in American history, there has always been a pushback against an expansive liberal reading of those ideas. There was one American critic, a Virginian, actually, who said, "Would it not be more true to say that no men are equal? That no man is ever born free, and no two men are equal." And that's just a very frank and hard-headed pushback against Rousseau's notions of equality, if you will. And we know in American experience that people live differently, that people make choices and have various outcomes to those choices. Sometimes they make great choices and they still fail. And then some choose to play Xbox, right? And don't get anything done at all.
Yeah.
Because they risk nothing, they don't deserve a return on nothing. So the idea that the American state should be retooled or purposed to promote the abstract idea of human equality is a theme in American history, but we have a great many stories to tell about this. This is not the only thing that's going on. And like I said, there's always been a critical pushback against that. The case today is that no one's allowed to make that criticism anymore. even in private institutions, if you have reservations about these criticisms, or like me, you have reservations about wild statements like race does not exist. No, race exists, and it's actually part of our fundamental law in this country. If you look at the census, it asks about this. If you look at the way that the federal government funnels money into organizations, race is a factor. Affirmative action is the law.
Yes, and the concept of white privilege is everywhere.
So. Absolutely. So what I did was I offered some criticisms. I sat down with the members of the board, and I posed them several questions. I said, do you know about the critical race theorists? Do you know about Ibram Kendi and all of these people, Robin DiAngelo? And they didn't know a thing about them. And I said, well, they say that colorblind racism is their number one target. People that say race is not a thing, those are their biggest enemies. And
right. That's the center-right sort of position.
Indeed. I said, we should not make this a public statement of the school. We are going to attract a lot of attacks if we do that. And then I proceeded, because these are Protestants that I was speaking to, and Zionism is a major element in American Protestantism for various reasons, which I won't get into here. But I asked them, because this is something that they think a lot about and talk a lot about. I said, do you suppose that Jews are a social construct? And they looked at each other, and because they had never thought about this in their lives, and they said, no, we actually don't think so. We think God made them distinct, as opposed to all the other nations mentioned in the Bible. Right? There are a great many races mentioned in the Old Testament, and the Old Testament says they were all separated by God at the Tower of Babel, where the languages were all split up. You know, the original thing that they coalesced around, all the different peoples of the world, were the different languages in the book of Genesis. So I asked them that, and it had never occurred to them. And then I said, would you tell...
So uniquely, the Jews exist as a group, but they are the only one.
Yeah, they were certainly willing to say that. They weren't willing to say that European nations existed or exist now. I don't know. They were not thinking about the implications of what they were saying. It seemed clear to me. And then I lastly asked them, would you tell a Jew that race is a social construct? And they said, no, we would not. Their faces ran white. And I said, why? And they said, because we would get in trouble. And I said, well, why would I be willing to say something that you'd be afraid to say yourselves? They obviously hadn't thought about any of it. And I insisted with them that to say that these groups are different is not to disparage any group. In my understanding as a Christian man, God made people. And people have a certain dignity to them in spite of their differences. They live in different ways. They want different things. They have some group dynamics, however we might classify them. But God still loves them in spite of these differences. And I'm not, in teaching history, I've never been out to disparage different groups. What I've said is that they have differences, and this puts them into conflict with one another. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why we have this very strange system that survives to this day. The Native Americans here in the United States have reservations And the idea of the reservation is that they can preserve their ethnic distinctiveness and govern themselves with subsidies from the federal government. They have their own special laws. They have their own special tribal governments. They have their own measure of sovereignty. And this is a various and diverse thing, but it hasn't worked out very well, maybe for other reasons, but one of the special things that it has done is it's preserved their languages and folkways. One of the reasons that Navajo remains a language that you can actually go and learn, a language with a literature now that it's been written down, is because the Navajo Nation was put on a reservation.
Yes. And an interesting point here is that this group, Native Americans, are recognized not on cultural grounds, but genetic, ethnic, bloodlines.
Yes.
Because otherwise, Elizabeth Warren wouldn't be able to claim to be part whatever it was.
Yes.
It's down to bloodline. So this is a racial, genetic, ethnic group that exists here.
And Americans find themselves in this bizarre situation, which makes no logical sense, where our law recognizes these bloodline distinctions, these genetic distinctions, as valuable in some cases, and something to be disparaged and denied in others. And it works in a certain direction for the benefit of some and for the denigration of others, for the exclusion of others. And this is what we piously call equality in America. And I'm here to say it's built on a specific hatred of certain groups in America. We all know something about how Southerners are in particular disparaged in media and such. I was particularly happy to see, touched deep in my heart to see Apostolic Majesty on Millennial, was it yesterday?
Yes.
And he had put the melted face of General Lee in his avatar. And that was especially touching to me as a Southerner that Europeans and accomplished historians like Apostolic Majesty, my goodness, I would love to have his competency in history. I stand in awe of his work. But people from abroad have adopted the image of Lee as something that resonates with their identity. When my whole life I've been seeing him spat upon, I've been seeing his statues torn down. Down in New Orleans, where I drive, there is a lovely pillar, a pillar of marble in a traffic circle where the statue of Lee used to stand, and we called that Lee Circle. And now the statue is gone. The bronze statue of Lee is tarnishing away, hidden at the city waterworks. They didn't melt it down. Funny enough, the statues in New Orleans that were removed have been treated with more respect. This all happened a few years before the summer of Floyd. We just have these empty pedestals sitting around the city now. And now that we've seen these statues actually melted down and ritually destroyed, people are finding inspiration in these characters. People are finding inspiration and encouragement and reason to act and to think about these issues of identity and conflict between groups. And it comes from my own humble section, my own ruined section of America that I love so much. I'm very happy about that.
The melting of the statue was a horrible, horrible event. And the thing is, if race didn't exist, if it's not a real thing, then that there would be no need to melt that statue. We all know that the real reason it was melted was precisely that race is a real thing. And there is a particular group, a particular racial group in America that is systematically disparaged in exactly the way that it is accused of systematically disparaging every other group. No, it is the white American who is the victim of systemic racism in his own country. And if that were not the case, then that statue would still exist.
I have a story that we can close out on, and it's topical. I was thinking a lot about our upcoming discussion while I was driving late last night in the city. I picked up a load of Chinese people at the airport and drove them downtown to their hotel. And along the way, we passed homeless encampments. We passed large public buildings that have sat in ruins in New Orleans ever since Hurricane Katrina back in 2004. There are still these areas of the city that are in ruins or have been demolished. There are city blocks that stand empty because the buildings were all knocked down in the hurricane and nothing has been done about them. But most interesting is a large hospital. It's this big Art Deco building that stands empty because it was damaged in the hurricane and nothing has been done with it. The Chinese were asking me about the city. They were asking me about crime. They were asking me about safety. And I pointed out the hospital as we passed it. And I said, that building has been empty ever since Hurricane Katrina in 2004. And I told the gentleman sitting beside me, our leaders lack the will to do what is necessary. They are discouraged or malignant. They will not enforce the law. They will not act. They will not build. They won't do these things that are so necessary. They have alternate purposes. And he nodded as if he understood what I was saying. And we spoke briefly about San Francisco in this bizarre situation where the city was cleaned up so quickly to welcome the president of China for a summit. And they knew all about this. And I said, won't you send your president more often? I said, our leaders, in spite of calling your president names and such, our leaders care more about him than they do about us. They will actually do what is necessary in our cities because he visits, but they won't do it for us. And finally, we arrived at the hotel, which was one of the best in New Orleans, one of the most expensive, luxurious hotels in the city. And as we were unloading, I was helping them with their luggage out of the van. I was telling them about restaurants in the area and different things they ought to eat while they're in the city, because it's such a great city for eating. And while I was speaking to them, a crazed man of a certain complexion was ranting and raving in the street, screaming obscenities at us. And while I was speaking to these Chinese, he walked up to me and took me by the lapels and shook me and screamed in my face. And I was not reacting at all for some reason. I was in a very Zen mode. I didn't feel anything. The blood didn't start pumping. I was extremely chill. And I was telling myself, you know, no one can do anything. I can't do anything. Can't react at all. And this really impressed the Chinese. They skedaddled into the hotel. They thanked me and shook my hand and went away. And the bellhop at the hotel and I had a brief conversation afterwards. I jumped in the van, rolled down my window. The crazy man was leaving leaving the scene, you know, stumbling down the street. And I asked the bellhop, I said, so you just let these people manhandle cabbies around here? Is that how things work? And he said, you should have punched him. And I was very amused by that. I didn't say anything more to him. I said, I understand. I know you can't do anything. And I drove away. And this is how things work these days. You can't say anything. You can't do anything. If you do, you will be utterly destroyed. If I had become an item of news, you know, responding to that man that shook me in the street, I would have been deplatformed. You know, I wouldn't be able to do what I do to feed my family. I know my role is to be passive, to be the receiver of these things and not to respond, and even not to say much about anything to the people that I encounter, just as a matter of safety. But this obviously can't continue. There will be, there is demand that I hear people crying out for it, especially locals in the city. I drive lots of local people from their work to the rough places that they live, the areas of the city that are not policed anymore, because there are no police, and because the city lacks the will to enforce the law. And if the policemen did enforce the law, the city would hold them up as examples and utterly destroy their lives. They are disincentivized from doing their job, the policemen. It seems an impossible line of work to me. And the city cannot recruit them in spite of all of their incentives. The locals, they tell me, I'm afraid. There are shootings, there are robberies, there are carjackings. People disregard the law everywhere that I go. I can't live like this. I have to leave. I have to get out of the city. And eventually there must come a tipping point. There, for every action, there is a reaction. There must be a point in which these blind, false, ideological notions in America about the conflict between groups of Americans, those ideological notions must fall away. They cannot survive encounters with reality, with how people actually live, how people actually believe, how people actually act. Man is historical. Our connections and our loyalties are real, and they motivate us. And we are not motivated by abstract ideals so well, so readily, so vitally as we are the real aspects of living. So history survives, man is historical, and that's why some of the things that we regret about our way of living in the West now and our decrepit state, they will change, they must change.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. This has been a fascinating talk, George. So thank you very much for agreeing to do this. There are two super chats. Well, three. Just two. Does George know why aristocratic titles, i.e. the Duke of New Orleans, never took off in America, either during the 13 colonies or after independence with the Confederacy?
I love the thought. I sincerely do. Those are made illegal in federal law in the Constitution itself. So it's in our very fundamental law. The Philadelphia Constitution bans the use of titles of nobility. And the Constitution also guarantees a Republican form of government everywhere in the domain of the United States. So we do not have titles, we don't have noble titles, we don't have knighthoods, and we have representative government, but that is formally in the antebellum South. Slave owners acted in a feudal role towards those that they owned, their slaves. So even though the master of Homus House did not have a formal title, he didn't have a title of nobility. He was not the Earl of Homus House. He was not the Count of Earl of Homus House. He was just the proprietor, the master of Homus House. He had a role analogous to that of a feudal lord. And when all things worked at their best in that system, it meant that everyone connected with that estate would stay put for many generations, not unlike they did in feudal Europe.
Right. Okay. So it was a daily reality, even though it was not called that, and it was illegal in law. Amazing.
Yes. Yes. It was informally true, though it was banned by the Constitution. And this is another aspect of Southern civilization. The people that wrote about themselves at that time, and the people that wrote about it afterwards, would take that connection to feudal Europe as a credit to that civilization. They thought of themselves as continuing a medieval European tradition. And they believed that in continuing in that tradition, that they were carrying on something from their homeland, from the old country. If you want more information about that, let's see, Eugene Genovese wrote an excellent book called The Mind of the Master Class. It is a gigantic brick of a book, but it is an excellent source about these things. He quotes primary sources very extensively. Another example of that is another author I cited earlier, Richard M. Weaver, wrote a lovely book. What is it called? I have it here, I believe. The Southern Tradition at Bay. That's what it's called. Both of them have chapters about that medieval connection.
Right. That sounds fascinating. And then the other question is, does George consider America to be a nation?
I think that the Americans are several peoples. And I do not know how they might be classified, how they might divide from each other potentially. I think it would be a catastrophe if we were politically divided. Though it could restore us in many ways as well. I mean, materially, it would certainly impoverish us. But there are other goods that could come out of it, spiritual goods, for instance. Perhaps people would grow closer to their families and more highly value marriage ties, ties to their children, their relationship with their parents. There are all sorts of good things that could come out of a more local view, even if it was out of necessity, because they couldn't go to the next state. They couldn't travel across the country to take a job, say. So I don't know how the United States could be classified. I don't think it makes much sense to talk about Americans without lots of qualifications. One of my favorite Southern writers, Donald Davidson, said that the American experience is such that you cannot say American without asking from where in America. The regional designation is still a very important one, though I think our Northerners would discount that aspect. They would still make a distinction that they were not Southerners, thereby proving our point.
Right. Okay. Well, this is. I think there are all sorts of different avenues here that we could explore, but it's, I think, in and of itself, this has been a very nice talk, and I've enjoyed it. And I think the viewers have as well. There are very nice comments posted on Odyssey about it. Well, let's end it there. I'll be back tomorrow night. Let me just see who's on tomorrow night. Harry Robinson, then Ban the BBC, then Island Watch, and then Lucas Gage. So that'll be another interesting night. In the meantime, I hope you've all enjoyed this. George, any last words before we stop?
Yes, I don't mind promoting a book that I've recently republished. I understand it'll take a couple of weeks before internet retailers will pick it up and put it for sale. But I've republished an old history of Reconstruction in the American South. It's from the turn of the century. It's called The Civil War and Reconstruction in Alabama by Walter Fleming. And if you watch my social media, I will let everybody know as soon as it is available. I've actually just ordered the first box of those books for myself. And that's one of my side hustles that I'm working on since I lost my career teaching.
I'm very sorry that happened. People can, your social media links are in the description and will be on the Millennial website as well. So I hope people do follow you. Well, this has been great. So, George, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Everyone else, I will see you tomorrow night. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.